Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's
Mouth. Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast, at least once a week, aimed to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 317, I have the pleasure of being joined by Drs. Mari Rodriguez and Avni Finn to discuss the November edition of Retinal Physician. November 2021 brings an edition focusing on deep learning and artificial intelligence in the field of retina, low vision resources for patients, and applications of intraoperative OCT and robotic surgery moving forward. Remember, you can find these articles and all Retinal Physician articles for free online at retinalphysician.com. Thank you again to their team for finding the articles. You can claim CME credits for this podcast by clicking on the link in the episode description. Remember, all discussants will have their disclosures posted there in the relevant disclosures section. Finally, a plug for our new podcast coming from the American Academy of Ophthalmology, Experts in Sight. Look for it in the Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Stitcher, and Spotify. Experts in Sight is a multi-specialty podcast I'll be hosting. It will have retina, but it will also have glaucoma and cornea and peds and plastics and refractive and neuro and all of those other specialties. So it's a great way to catch up on other fields. If you're a retina specialist, if you're a trainee or someone from another specialty listening, or a comprehensive ophthalmologist or optometrist, I would highly suggest it. I've learned a ton just doing it. I'm going to have to go back and listen to them as they come out. And again, if you have friends who always were jealous that you had a retina podcast to listen to and they were in their subspecialty and did not have a podcast, please give them a heads up. Experts in Sight from the Academy will be out bi-weekly, so twice a month. We'll still be releasing this podcast once a month, and look forward to hearing feedback on that as well. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the November 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com. And these articles have to do with artificial intelligence, low vision, and then some new technological advancements in retinal surgery. Joining me for this episode in alphabetical order, first Dr. Avni Finn from Nashville, Tennessee. Avni, welcome.
Thank you, Jay, for having me.
And Dr. Mari Rodriguez joining us from Massachusetts. Mari.
Thank you, Jay. It's a pleasure.
So the first article we're going to talk about was written by Daniel Wang and Jennifer Lin from University of Illinois, Chicago. It's an update on artificial intelligence, deep learning in retina. Remember, for these articles, if you want to read the full article, you can online. Otherwise, we're just going to kind of use them as jumping points for discussion. So just to summarize, they talk a little bit about some things we've talked about before on the program, which are hot topics in our field, which is the idea that computer systems using algorithms that use deep learning, where the computer kind of has this unstructured ability to develop hidden layers that were not coded in, develop its own sort of language to understand information and then output results. And that allows for sometimes more accurate outputting, more output that can either simulate or even exceed a human ability to interpret results. So this has been applied most famously in diabetic retinopathy. 3 years ago, the IDXDR was the first FDA-approved AI-based medical device to detect more than mild diabetic retinopathy. And there's been additional systems similar to this in Europe. The authors also talk about how this can be used for ROP screening, how this can be used for AMD, sickle cell. And then they also talk a little bit about some of the limitations of these processes. But it does seem to be the future, Avni. And I think that this is something we've all talked about quite a bit. And COVID may have distracted us a little bit from this, given what it's done over the last year and a half, but this is still kind of working in the background, much like a deep learning algorithm works in the background to potentially change the way we screen for retinal diseases, and maybe even something we've talked about on this program, how we even approach our day-to-day clinical activity. You know, could we get to the point where, similar to cardiologists read their own EKGs, but there is some sort of interpretation that is automatically produced, there's some sort of waveform interpretation that's done based on patterns. OCT would be a little more complicated, but in terms of Avni, what you see, you know, you read this article and kind of going forward, what do you kind of visualize for your clinics in 5 or 10 or 15 years? I mean, do you think that you'll still have trainees or yourself kind of interpreting the results? Do you think that this will kind of be built into our software where we won't necessarily be interpreting as much? How much do you think treatment, as it gets more complicated, more options, will be guided by some sort of computer algorithm indicating maybe best options?
Yeah, I think, I think in general, when we first started talking about AI, it seemed like a little bit of a scary thing to be incorporated into our practices. But I think that the more we've all learned about it, like you said, Jay, I think it is, you know, part of the future. And I'm not sure how it will be integrated into our clinical practices. I think some of the ways in which I see it potentially being implemented is that, you know, an AI algorithm is perhaps screening or making certain recommendations to us based on imaging, and, you know, in a way reading an OCT to us and alerting us to certain findings. But that at the end of the day, the physician still, you know, interprets those findings or those readings in their own way, and makes treatment decisions based on that. So I do think it will get incorporated into practice. I still think that there's going to be a large role for physicians being that final gatekeeper in terms of how they interpret that data and how they apply it to decision making for their patients.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Mari, to follow on Avni's point, I think the simplest example you can give, let's say in our clinics day to day, would be, you know, a patient who comes in, you see an OCT, it looks like wet AMD, there's subretinal fluid, they're in the right age group. I think the computer could interpret all of that and give a recommendation you should inject anti-VEGF. That's where I think where the human part of it comes in to kind of interpret in the context of the patient. It's a very different sort of conversation if that's a 75-year-old, very functional patient with good vision versus a 95-year-old patient with advanced dementia who doesn't have very good day-to-day functioning. Maybe it's not, and those are very extreme examples, but I think that goes to Avni's point that there's going to be some sort of maybe guidelines that help us make decisions based on findings we don't necessarily pick up ourselves, but that it's going to be very difficult to kind of replace sort of the nuanced humanistic aspect of what we do as doctors.
I totally agree with both of you guys' points. I think, you know, we're still going to be the physicians and judgment. I don't think computers can replace the judgment that we have. And as you were pointing out, when we look at a patient, we take into consideration not only what we see in an image, but, you know, their life story, how, as you say, dementia, functionality in terms of other things, what they're looking for with our treatment recommendation. So I think that when we look at a patient, we take all those things into consideration as well. And I do agree that, you know, a few years ago, it sounded really scary to think about AI and almost like it was going to replace physicians. But I see it as, you know, this is the future. We just have to embrace it. And I think that it's going to play a role. It's going to play a role, especially in screening. And I think it's going to be a positive role. I think we are going to see more patients. Right now, only 40% of diabetic patients obtain their annual recommended screenings. So if, you know, some of these cameras are implemented in the primary care offices and, they send patients to us, then we can help more people. So I think it's going to be overall positive.
Avni, we get data points from some of our older studies and newer studies about, for example, diabetic retinopathy. If you're mild, moderate, or severe, the reason these categorizations were originally important was it conveyed some sort of percentage risk that you would progress to a visually significant complication. And you could say the same for what patients are highest risk for conversion of a fellow eye from dry AMD to wet AMD. Well, there's certain clinical characteristics that were defined through trials, like, you know, significant RPE changes, or, you know, now with OCTA, the presence of a non-exudative, a CNVM, an OCTA, maybe obviously convey a higher risk of conversion. And then, you know, even things that aren't discussed here, but things that are argued or debated in our field, should you treat For example, a patient with lattice who's got atrophic holes, you know, which patients should you treat? And part of the reason the discussion is difficult is because we don't necessarily like doing interventions that carry a certain risk when we don't know the number needed to treat. And so when you don't actually know that number because we just don't have good enough data, then in general, we aren't doing as aggressive therapy. For example, we're not going to, maybe it will change, but we're not necessarily going to start injecting every patient with mild non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy with anti-VEGF monthly. We're not going to inject every patient with a fellow eye with high risk conversion before they actually convert. But I'm curious, and where I'm going with this is we have kind of this dual diagnostic and therapeutic advancement that's happening. We have potentially with AI and deep learning, the ability to maybe stratify that risk better. Maybe patient A and patient B look very similar to us when they walk in, but an algorithm can tell us which one has actually the true high risk. And then we have better therapies. You know, Susvimo, or the port delivery system, was just approved this past week by the FDA. We're going to have more and more kind of therapies that are longer lasting that maybe decrease the risk of monthly therapy for, let's say, diabetic retinopathy or wet AMD. So I'm curious, Avni, do you think that, you know, we've talked a little bit about how the algorithm is not going to make the decisions for us. Do you think our interventions in terms of timing are going to change a lot in the next, you know, year or 2 years or 3 years, when you, or 5, 10 years if you look beyond, as those kind of two things, the diagnostic tools and the therapeutic tools advance? Do you think that we're actually going to end up treating people earlier to catch these diseases as an earlier stage?
That's a great question. I think it'll depend really on where we go with both the diagnostic and therapeutic advances. I'm not sure that we'll necessarily be treating patients earlier, but we may be personalizing treatment to our patients a bit better. And I think that, like you were alluding to, deep learning and these AI algorithms can actually potentially help us do that with so many different therapeutic interventions kind of coming down the pipeline. Figuring out which one might be best for which patient. I'm sure there are imaging biomarkers that we're not capturing on a day-to-day basis looking at individual patients, but that perhaps a deep learning algorithm can catch for us or highlight for us to alert us to certain findings that, you know, a patient might be better suited to a certain treatment modality, be it, you know, adding an Ang-2 inhibitor or treating a patient earlier, like you were saying, than we might otherwise think of as we're kind of going through a busy clinic. So I do think there's a role for combining these deep learning modalities and these new therapeutics coming down the pipeline.
So, but Mari, let's transition to this next article, which is about low vision as a litmus test for retinal therapy by Rashid Taher and Mark Gannon, an MD and OD, wrote this together. We've talked about, again, low vision in the context of retina in the past, but I think it's worth repeating because I think we all have a tendency, and I'm guilty of this. Maybe you two aren't, but I think we can fall into the trap in our day-to-day that we go through. We see a lot of patients, we're treating OCTs, we're injecting, but you know, patients functionally want something that will help them. And I think this was a really helpful article. I encourage people listening to read it because it summarizes all the kind of different options rather than have it just be a black box. Hey, you go get a low vision referral, kind of understand what are some of the advances that have happened. And with the electronics advances, there's actually quite a few options that were described here that may help a patient. You know, Mari, what's been kind of your experience? You know, one of my issues I find, especially with COVID, is low vision referrals became very tough to get patients in an expedited manner. There's at least in our area, a shortage of optometrists and or ophthalmologists who really specialize in low vision. It's kind of an unfilled need in a way to have somebody in that setting. Have you had a similar experience in terms of patients? And, you know, what sort of things one thing that came to me when I read this article was, well, maybe retina practices should incorporate some of this in-house. Like maybe, again, it may not be a moneymaker. It may not be something that is from a pure capitalistic sense, something that adds value, but it may be valuable enough to patients to have some sort of low vision, even if it's not a formal doctor, but some sort of resources or something in-house. Because one of the reasons these patients struggle is it's hard for them to get from point A to point B. It's hard for a family member to take time off. And so when you start adding in visits and providers, it can get pretty challenging.
So I agree. I think COVID has been difficult in many ways, and this is one of the areas that our patients have definitely suffered. In my practice, we consult for basically like a comprehensive clinic, Lexington Eye Associates, and they do have an in-house low vision specialist that goes there. And so it's easier to get my patients that need it plugged in there faster. The patients that I see in my retina only practice, it's harder to get them into the low vision evaluation. We do it through the optometry school here at Worcester, and the wait time could be 2 to 3 months. And, I always tell the patients, definitely go to that appointment. It's extremely helpful what they can do for you. And I think, you know, the technology is great, and it has really empowered some of these patients. But I would say that I think what is still lagging is the financial help for some of these new technologies. So I don't know how to solve that issue.
Amni, what about you? What's been kind of your experience? You've worked in two geographic areas now. I mean, do you think it sounds like Mari's had a similar kind of issue. Do you think this is maybe more universal in terms of just not having good access to these services?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. Now, you know, at both areas where I've worked, I've had a really great low vision option available to my patients, but like both of you, access to getting patients into those low vision clinics or centers is really difficult. And they're often, you know, I've worked in satellites in both of my positions as well, and they're often not closely located to patients. So again, then you have this issue of a patient that is already having, you know, severe visual difficulty, and they have to drive or get someone to drive them to an appointment that, you know, is pretty far away, because like you were saying, Jay, low vision is, you know, there aren't as many specialists who really specialize in low vision. And then also, you know, there may be an optometrist who does some low vision, but doesn't have access to all of these amazing technologies. Or, you know, I find that the low vision specialists who work with a library or work with occupational therapy and then have, you know, different resources available to them are oftentimes the best resource for patients, but not all low vision specialists are equal in their access to those technologies and those resources. And so sending a patient to a center that has access to all of that is difficult, and the wait times are really, really quite long. Sometimes so long that, like, I've had patients just say, you know, that's just too long. Either it's too far for me, or I can't wait for that appointment. I think we all realize the immense value, though, of low vision to our patients.
Yeah, and just I'm trying to take a step back and just think, and I guess the other thing, they don't really talk here about the reimbursement insurance part of it. I've had patients, you know, get evaluated and say they have these options, and obviously they are motivated, but these options can be pretty expensive. You know, the options can range from, hey, here's a simple tablet that you can enlarge the font of your phone, and there's apps on your phone you can use, to some of these actual devices that you wear are pretty expensive. I haven't seen that many patients get successful coverage because it sort of falls. It's a lot of times assigned under vision insurance, not medical insurance. And then, you know, had to try to help people with documentation to get that done. And again, I'm just thinking, you know, I think retina practices, from a true fundamental, just realistic level, I guess from a management level, they feel that there's bigger fish to fry. They make bigger margins on injections and on medications. And that's a whole thing. It's a whole different sort of thing to manage that can be complicated. But I just wonder, again, if you could somehow make this mutually beneficial where it's rolled in house. Again, you have to give some sort of incentive for people to do that. But I think part of the issue is the lack of insurance coverage and then kind of the price point. And again, Mari, you can correct me if you've noticed anything differently, but that's one of the common complaints besides wait times that patients will have, is that they simply can't afford, or they're worried that if they pay for the device and it's non-refundable, maybe it doesn't actually help them and then they're stuck.
No, I totally agree. And just today, I had a patient that has, you know, severe geographic atrophy, and she was telling me that she was evaluated by a low vision specialist and she loved it there, but I guess whatever they offered her was $140, and you know, the insurance was not going to cover that for her. And you know, $140 can be a lot of money for some of our patients to pay out of pocket. So so unfortunately, she couldn't afford that. So yeah.
Yeah, you know, we've tried to put into place a lot of external documentation, and when the appointments are made, you know, make sure all the insurance information is in line. But a lot of these devices are very expensive, and same as the experience both of you have had, they are not always covered, and they can be a big financial burden for patients, and so it can deter them from using them or even trying them.
Let's shift gears to surgery. The last two articles we'll talk about are different technologies. Again, we've talked about a bit, but it's important again to keep up with these things because it continues to evolve. And so Justice Ehlers was senior author on this article on the emerging role of intraoperative OCT for retinal surgery. And some of these things we've discussed again before. They talk about some of the commercially available options, including Leica, Zeiss, and Hoxrite all have intraoperative OCT options. And, you know, they are talking about the idea now, which we've discussed, is the integration of a 3D heads-up display with the intraoperative OCT. And one of the complaints of the about intraoperative OCT in the past was the way it was set up, you really had a very minimal, small window of view, even though you had that OCT cut. The original displays were kind of in your ocular up in one eye on the side. And people always kind of felt, well, if you could get this in a bigger screen, kind of side by side with what we were actually seeing, that it would really incorporate well with the heads up display. And then they talk about things that have been discussed before. Instruments not casting shadows are traditional instruments for metallic that causes the shadow effect and scatter. So using instruments that use a semi-transparent material would be helpful. And then the idea of what's kind of coming down the pipeline, it the same sort of image analysis we talked about in the clinic, well, can you improve the OCT quality here that you're using, right? Can you get the same sort of swept source imaging you can get in the clinic and deliver it at a very high resolution to the surgeon? And then they end by talking about some of the trials we've discussed before, Discover and Pioneer, and where they've shown benefits, including in subretinal gene therapy. You know, Avni, I know you trained at Duke, and so you had a lot of exposure to intraoperative OCT throughout your training. I think that we've said many times that it would be kind of the future. We'll talk a little bit about some of the real-world concerns in terms of costs and reimbursement and things like that. But in terms of incorporation with the heads-up display, that seems to be overcome now, and that will help with a lot of the issues people reported. But the instrument issue is interesting because, again, there's a classic set of instruments that are designed by companies that surgeons are used to. It's pretty difficult to get a surgeon to change what forceps or things they use once they feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. That seems like, to me, that would be the biggest limitation going forward, is just getting people to shift over instruments, especially you would have to kind of ensure that whatever instruments are designed work really well, A, and B, don't cost more than current options.
Yeah, I think that's a big barrier. And if you could potentially design like a sleeve or something that goes over the instrument rather than you know, having the instrument be replaced completely, that might be an alternative way to go about this. But that's a big issue. You know, when I've used intraoperative OCT in the past, the shadowing created by the instrumentation does really limit what you're able to see. And then you have to kind of maneuver around both the imaging system and your instrument in order to get the right image for what you're looking for. So it, one, takes a lot more time, and doesn't allow you to actually get the visualization that is beneficial and added with the OCT. So I do think the instrumentation is a big barrier, and trying to figure out a way to make that instrumentation compatible without replacing it, I think is an important thing to consider. And then the other thing you talked about was just, you know, the new integration of the OCT, intraoperative OCT into the heads up display, I think is a big barrier that's been overcome, because you're right, before having like a little screen off to the side where you saw your OCT image, it was almost as you have to stop operating because you're shifting your focus and moving your eyes to another area while you're operating. So you have to, you know, take time to look at that other image. And so if it's all in the same view, I do think that makes a difference to incorporating it into real-time surgery.
Yeah. And Mari, I think from a practical level, one thing that I didn't really realize as a fellow and then realized more and more as I went beyond is it's not like you can easily turn over equipment in an office or a surgical center like day to day or month to month or year to year. I mean, some people lease their equipment, but most ORs buy their microscopes. And if they have a microscope that works, it's not necessarily going to fly to say, hey, we need to get this heads-up display this year. And oh, there's a better one this year, let's upgrade. Same goes for intraoperative OCT. To kind of show that value added can be tough. And especially if you have a working set of equipment, especially if you share an ASC with anterior segment surgeons who don't necessarily use some of the technology, it can be kind of hard to push for that. I think that's one of the big reasons, besides the fact you don't bill, which is maybe there, maybe not, and maybe that would help push things. It's one of the big reasons I think maybe that just the integration, widespread adoption hasn't been there.
No, I agree. I think the economics definitely are going to play a big role in whether we adopt this technology more widely or not. And there's always two camps when it comes to technology. You know, they're the early adopters and those late adopters. I think I'm in the group of the more late adopter. And it's not just in surgery. It took me a long time to upgrade to an iPhone myself. You know, so everyone, you know, makes the decision, you know, based on whether the expense is worth it, whether it provides a clear clinical benefit. And, you know, we have to demonstrate that, you know, that whatever new technology we're going to use is going to really make a clinical impact. It's going to improve the patient outcome or improve the patient, the surgeon's experience, or make the clinic or the surgical flow better. And at least for me at this time, it doesn't seem that this IOCT is something that I would jump in the bandwagon for.
But it's funny you bring up iPhone, because I was a late adopter too, and I was super, super resistant. I remember I started residency in ophthalmology, and I had some, you know, T-Mobile BlackBerry knockoff that didn't really take pictures, but did what it needed to do. And then I remember starting on the consult service, and the plastics fellows, who won't be listening to this podcast because they don't care about this subject matter, the plastics fellows were like, hey, you saw the patient, send me a picture. And I'd be like, okay, like, do I need to buy like a separate camera? They're like, oh, just take your picture with your iPhone. I'm like, well, I don't have an iPhone. And I remember I bought like an iPhone, but didn't hook it up to the networks because I didn't want to like, I don't know. It was silly. And then I was using that on Wi-Fi, and they would just get so upset because I would lose Wi-Fi in the hospital. And they'd be like, there's like a 30. They'd be like, we expect like an immediate photo. And I just was so resistant to getting an Apple product that I just didn't do it. And now I'm like all Apple. I have like an iPhone, a Mac, and everything. It's just like, yeah. So the IOCT, let's switch to talk about robotic surgery, because that's the last article. Matthew Gerber and Jean-Pierre Hubschman wrote about robotic technology for retinal surgery. And he came on the podcast way back to talk about robotic surgery. Again, one of those things that we were talking a lot about two, three years ago. And then with COVID-19, everything has kind of been under the surface. People haven't talked about it. But the idea of an intraocular surgical robotic system, they talk about the Precise surgical system available in Europe, which has been used in Belgium and other countries. And it's pretty incredible, right? And one of the things Dr. Hubschman said, Mari, when he came on the podcast was, and again, this is an early adopter, late adopter kind of argument, but his argument was, if you compare, you know, the fine sort of motion, if you compare the tremor rates, you compare all these things between a human hand and a robotic system, it's like no question like which way the pendulum swings. The robotic system tends to be more precise. And they talk about that here. They talk about positional accuracy is about 20 to 40 microns for a human surgeon during retinal surgery, which I will say that is actually, you know, pat on the back for human beings. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
It's that precise. three micrometers for the precise. So it's about six times better, even at the for the best human. You know, the limitation. So I think these are the things you can sort of talk about, right? As someone who, like me, is a little more of a late adopter, we can talk about price, we can talk about costs. I just think this goes back to our AI. It ties very nicely back to our conversation about AI in the context of a patient. I just don't know how you build in the safeguards so that, especially for intraocular surgery, where small movements can make a big difference, you kind of guard against some of the things that can happen during surgery. Patient movement, patient conversation, questions, like those are things that can change the context very quickly. One can argue that the robot could withdraw instruments faster than a human hand. That may be true, but kind of having that, it's sort of like having the self-driving Tesla and like not touching the steering wheel. It's like a little bit like, yes, that could be great, but in the one in 10,000 where it doesn't work great, well, that's a really big problem. I don't know. Then, Avni, you may have arguments the other way, but Mara, I'm just curious to get your thoughts on what you think of robotic retinal surgery, for example.
So, you know, robotic surgery has really revolutionized some fields like urology, and, you know, 90% of procedures of prostatectomies are done with, with a da Vinci. And, you know, why wouldn't we do the same thing with retina? Well, I think that some of the things for retina are a little different. Like, you know, our surgeries, number one, are faster than, you know, prostate surgery. You know, we like do 45 minutes to an hour, and just setting up a robot takes a long time. So would that make sense if you're going to have 3 to 4 patients in one morning to set up and add up the time that you're going to have to set up just to set up the robot? Just one thing. So, and then the thing is, like, you know, for example, for like prostate surgery, it revolutionized things because you went from an open procedure to laparoscopic procedure. So patients were staying in the hospital instead of 3 days, just one day. But are we going to be able to give that clinical improvement to our patients? I'm not so sure. So I don't know. I think we have a long way to go for retina surgery to adopt robotic surgery. That's my opinion.
Avni, what's your take?
Yeah, you know, I agree with Mari in large part. I think, you know, I would say, though, when we look at da Vinci and its adoption into like gynecologic surgery and urology, it's still operated by a human. And so, you know, I think any robotic surgery that we're considering would still, you know, just like we were having the AI conversation, I think there still has to be a human surgeon who's operating the device and, you know, kind of the gatekeeper for the next step that the device takes. I do think there's a real role for some particular either surgical steps or surgical procedures that the article alluded to, but like the creation of subretinal blebs. And now that we have, you know, we're moving towards potentially gene therapy, gene delivery that might be delivered in a subretinal manner, always having, you know, the ability to precisely deliver medication into the correct space, right? Not having it be sub-RPE or intraretinal and always having it be subretinal and a precise amount delivered. I think that that's a really unique opportunity potentially for a robot, especially given then the cost of the medication itself and the potential repercussions for not delivering that type of medication either successfully or correctly. So I do see opportunity for robotic surgery in something like that. But I agree. I think there are probably more limitations at this point than you know, than advantages to make it worthwhile. The cost being a huge thing, the time being another big factor that Mari alluded to. Until it can be, you know, a more efficient way to do things. I don't see it kind of taking over like routine vitrectomy surgery, but I think that there is a subset of procedures that it could be invaluable for.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think to kind of bring your point and Mari's point about benefits being shown, I think that you'd have to, like you said, show the benefit in a situation. Subretinal gene therapy seems like a great opportunity for that. But then I think the financial part of it is the market has to be big enough that mm-hmm. someone's willing to foot the bill for a robotic system. And so maybe the only conditions that we were referencing that would work for would be AMD and DR from just just how common those procedures could potentially be. Then maybe it makes sense to have a robotic setup. I mean, they're sort of in betweens. I've seen Avni that they not necessarily a robot, but essentially where the surgeon would have to put the device into place, but then once it in the subretinal space, it's a calibrated device that delivers a fixed amount. Mm-hmm. Which isn't exactly robotic, mm-hmm. but the idea being that part is taken out of the surgeon's hands, you know, the amount is just dosed appropriately. And then it has a sensor to kind of know when it's broken through that plane. And none of this is commercially available. It's just things that people have talked about or demoed, but I think it's an interesting concept. I don't know. Amari and Avi, I'll let you guys have like kind of the last word here. I think this podcast and this episode, I mean, the things we're talking about are all things that we have talked about in the past and have continued to grow. And I think we can see sort of routes where they incorporate. I think personally, like if I had to vote on the things we talked about, I think low vision devices will continue to improve. That's not really a hot take. I think that the AI thing will help a lot for screening, but maybe not so much for decision making. I think that's kind of what we talked about. But I actually think that I think intraoperative OCT has a lot more traction from being incorporated just into our standard day-to-day viewing systems within 2 decades. I'm not so sure about the robotics part of it, simply from a cost benefit analysis, unless someone really pours resources into marketing and pushing it forward. To where patients and providers really feel it's beneficial. But Mari, I don't know, your final thoughts before we break.
I agree with you. I think in terms of the things that I want to see in the future, maybe more funding for low vision devices. You know, I think the technology has significantly improved, but we need more ways to help the patients actually access the technology there with financial assistance. Screening, I think AI is going to help a lot. And I see that happening hopefully in the next 5 to 10 years. But the more, you know, the intraoperative OCT and the robotic, assisted retina surgery, I see that further down the line, many, many years down the line to be widely adopted. So that's my opinion.
Avni? Yeah.
I think I agree with you guys, and it's also a matter of, you know, where the patient need is. Like you both said, low vision and AI, those are things that we see on a daily basis, you know, especially low vision with, you know, treating patients medically in the clinic. That's where the need is. And similarly with AI, I think it has a much larger potential role for impact because of all the medical retina diseases that it can be applied to. Whereas, you know, although we all love to operate, we operate less frequently. And so unfortunately the need and also the cost associated with surgical advances, puts it lower on the list in terms of things that one, will be adopted, and two, where there's a greater need for it.
Well, Avni Finn, Mari Rodriguez, thank you so much for joining us for this preview of Retinal Physician. It was great having you on, and look forward to talking to you both soon.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you, Jay.
Many thanks to Drs. Mari Rodriguez and Avni Finn for joining me.
Remember, you can find all 317 of our episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. They're sorted by category and easily searchable. You can also find us in the Apple Podcast and Google Podcast apps. We're on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and you can contact us via social media, via email directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com, or by clicking on the link on our website to contact us. We love getting feedback, and 5-star reviews are always super helpful in the Apple Podcast Store. Remember to check out Experts in Sight, the new Academy podcast I'll be hosting. Again, multi-specialty first episode cornea released on the week of October 25th. And look out for more episodes twice a month from the Academy. It should be a great venture. We will still be releasing weekly with the Retina Podcast. Thanks to our team here, Drs. Mike Benincasa, Louis Kine, Angela Chang. Thanks to Jen Ford and the team at Pentavision for allowing us to preview the retinal physician articles. Thank you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.